This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Monday, saying nothing does not mean yes. New South Wales joins the list of states toughening up its sexual consent laws.
I don't understand what the opposition to just checking in and making sure it's okay, making sure there is consent.
And why are 5 million Australians not getting enough nutritious food to eat? First today, there's been a dramatic development in the long-running Claremont serial killer case, with the accused man pleading guilty to attacks on two women. Bridget Fitzgerald joins me now from Perth. Bridget, what's happened today?
Rachel, in a pre-trial hearing this morning, the accused man, Bradley Robert Edwards, has changed his pleas regarding attacks on two women. So he has today pleaded guilty to an attack on a woman in the Perth suburb of Huntingdale in 1988 and of the rape of a 17-year-old at Karrakatta Cemetery in 1995. But it's very important to be clear that Mr. Edwards has continued to plead not guilty in relation to the three murder charges, and those charges relate to Sarah Spears, Jane Rimmer and Kira Glennon. And this turn of events happened this morning in this pre-trial hearing in front of a large crowd who was at the court, including the fathers of Sarah Spears and Kira Glennon.
What does this mean for the trial?
Rachel, we don't yet know why he's changed his plea with regard to these two matters, but we have heard from the state prosecutor today that these guilty pleas will, in fact, likely cut short Mr. Edwards' trial by at least 3 months. So it's due to start next month. At this point, there shouldn't be a change to the date. This trial should begin on November the 18th. It was originally slated to last for 9 months. It's expected now to be cut short.
What else is likely to be heard at that pre-trial hearing?
So this hearing is really just to determine what evidence is admissible during the trial. So it's going to look into some very specific issues, different parts of statements from the hundreds of witnesses that have been involved in this case.
This case has been hugely significant in Western Australia, hasn't it?
Yes, Rachel, it really has. It's been one of those, the word haunted has been used to describe what this case has done to Perth for really the past 25 years or so. So Mr. Edwards was arrested in December 2016, and that was in fact 20 years after the disappearance of the first Claremont victims, Sarah Spears. So she'd been out celebrating with friends on Australia Day, and then she disappeared. And it's seen the similar circumstances have played out over the next few months and year, with the disappearance of Kira Glennon. She disappeared in March 1997, and 23-year-old Jane Rimmer, who disappeared from the same area. So Claremont is quite a wealthy suburb of Perth, and really for people that live in that area, but also for West Australians and for people in Perth more broadly, this has really shaken them since the 90s.
Bridget Fitzgerald, thank you. In a coordinated campaign, Australia's major newspapers have printed thick black lines over their front page stories to highlight what media organisations say are increasing controls on press freedom. The media coalition behind the campaign says bringing potential wrongdoing into the spotlight has become much harder because of a slew of recent new laws. Police raids earlier this year on the ABC and the home of a News Corp journalist were seen by organisers of the unprecedented Unifying campaign as the last straw. Barbara Miller reports.
Getting Australia's media organisations to act in unity is, as one commentator put it, like herding cats. But that's what they've done today, with the front pages of all major newspapers just a series of black lines. The Right to Know campaign is calling for greater protection for journalists and whistleblowers and greater transparency from government. But will the front page splash work? A question for Dee Madigan, creative director of the advertising agency Campaign Edge.
Unfortunately, because most people do not buy hard copy newspapers, that's where it actually has its biggest visual impact, and they won't see that. And on your desktop, you can see a little bit if you pull up the news sites, you can see quite a bit. On your mobile, it gets a little bit lost, though. You only sort of see something tiny at the bottom. And unfortunately, most people consume their news on their mobile. However, what it really does is it gives the journalists a story to talk about, and that's kind of its point.
Is that the way then, through the reporting about the front pages, that the public's going to learn about this campaign?
Yes. Yes.
Commuters approached by The World Today hadn't seen the front pages, but were generally supportive of the campaign when told about it.
We're just becoming America. I thought Australia was a country of, you know, free speech. Obviously, that's not the case. It's just another example of the country going backwards.
So was what the media could report, was that something that's been concerning you before you saw this?
Oh, obviously. I mean, look, sometimes the media gets it wrong, but, you know, other times you want to hear the real story, but if the government's not allowing the press any freedom, well, then what are you listening to?
Somebody else decide what are the news that can be disclosed to the public. It's a bit unfair for us, for the public. We don't know what's happening.
I think the limits seem to be rather too strict here at the moment. Arbitrary decisions are being made and we don't know what's going on.
And what do you think about the media using its own platforms to campaign? Is that okay?
What else are they going to do?
Dee Madigan says she's not surprised the topic of press freedom has cut through in the general public.
I think it's the disengaged people because they don't trust politicians. And you have a whole lot of conspiracy theorists out there. And as it turns out, some of them are quite, they're right on the money with some of this stuff. So you tell them that the government's withholding information. They go, yeah, I always knew that.
Broadcasters, including the ABC, are also part of the Right to Know campaign.
The tax office can take money directly out of people's accounts, but you're not allowed to know.
The TV ad's really bad. There's just way too much in it, I think, for the public to understand it. I think it needs to be a little bit more, not dumbed down, but you have to choose less things to talk about for it to have more impact sometimes.
Concerns about new legislation have been growing for some time, but the raids on the ABC over stories by Dan Oakes and Sam Clark and on the home of News Corp political journalist Annika Smethurst have made press freedom a much more pressing issue. Annika Smethurst spoke this morning to 2GB Radio.
It's not about making journalists above the law, but it's about changing the laws so that journalism isn't a crime and that, you know, people out there know what the government is doing in their name.
Energy Minister Angus Taylor gave this response to the campaign.
Well, look, press freedom is an enormously important issue. There's no doubt about that. We have to get the balance right. There are national security considerations, and getting that balance right will be an ongoing and constant debate, and it should be, because this is an enormously important issue. That's why we've given it to the Parliamentary Committee on Intelligence and Security, one of the most prominent committees in the parliament.
But the opposition's Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, says that's not good enough.
It's not enough for the government to just use these platitudes and weasel words of saying we support freedom of the press when the reality is the government's not doing anything. What the Morrison government has to do is to rule out prosecution of Dan Oakes, Sam Clark from the ABC, and Annika Smethurst.
Organisers of the campaign hope it will make recommendations for change substantial enough that Australia is no longer referred to by newspapers such as the New York Times as the world's most secretive democracy.
Barbara Miller. Brian Toohey is a columnist for the Australian Financial Review and one of Australia's best-known investigative journalists. He's also the author of the new book, Secret, The Making of Australia's Security State. He spoke with me a short time ago.
What's happened is that the governments have become increasingly confident that they can stop criticism of what they're doing, and government agencies, particularly the intelligence agencies, by introducing more and more draconian laws, which are just about impossible to mount defences against. I might just give you an example of one from the 2018 Espionage and Foreign Interference Act. It makes it an offence to leak, receive, or publish any inherently harmful information, regardless of whether it's classified or not. It's so broad, it's very, very hard to see how you'd mount defences against those things.
So your argument is that the laws have been brought in and they're just far too broad for journalists to operate under.
for journalists who want to bring significant information to the public, yes, that's true. And this incredible range of things now, intangible damage and so forth, it is so sweeping that all of these laws need to be revised.
Do you think that ordinary people care about this? Will redacted front pages of the nation's newspapers today have an impact?
I think some people are disturbed, but I do think that the government is probably rightly picking up the view that as long as they keep saying this is necessary to keep you safe, that they'll be okay. I mean, I do think people were worried about the two raids on one on the ABC and one on a News Limited journalist. In the first case, there was absolutely no excuse for keeping secret the information about alleging that Australian Special Forces soldiers in Afghanistan had committed war crimes. That is something surely the public should know about. And it's also did the raid some 2.5 years after the story was a very well-researched story was first published. In the case of the News Limited journalist, what she did was say that, look, the head of Home Affairs Department wants to change the law to allow the Signals Directorate. It wants that to be able to, you know, surveil Australian citizens, right, which you can't really do at the moment. And the head of Home Affairs said, you know, the person who did that should be go to jail, and it was a terrible thing of the journalist and so forth to do. When all the journalist did was say that something that would have to be announced publicly maybe a couple of months later. If the law has to be made public, and if there's a change in the law, then the public are going to know about it. What is the problem?
The media coalition behind today's campaign is demanding a repeal of the laws that prevent the release of information that they see as in the public interest. A repeal of the laws has got to be a pipe dream, though, doesn't it?
I don't think it at all. I mean, surely they have to consolidate some of these laws. 83 anti-terrorism laws that deal with a lot of other things. Laws which are extraordinarily broad about doing economic damage or so forth and so on. I think most of those should be repealed, or alternatively you need to amend them. The trouble is there's been so many amended laws. Let me give you an example. In 1991, the then head of Treasury, Tony Cole, absolutely strongly opposed a recommendation from a committee headed up by a former High Court judge, which said you must make it a criminal offence for anyone to leak economic material that could damage the country. He said, I've looked back over the entire history of Australia and I can never see any economic information that was leaked that caused any damage. And he strongly opposed this law and said, look, the only damage that could be occur if it's brought in and governments misused it. So there is a public servant saying, look, we don't need to have any laws saying you can't publish any classified or unclassified information about the economy. Now, there's two separate laws that have been brought in that cover that.
That was Brian Toohey, author of the new book, Secret, The Making of Australia's Security State. New South Wales is a step closer to introducing new sexual consent laws, which would require both parties to actively agree to sexual activity as opposed to just not saying no. The state's Law Reform Commission has made the draft recommendation following similar changes in Tasmania and Victoria. It's being welcomed by women's groups and domestic violence services, but some senior law experts argue the laws will risk jailing people for genuine mistakes. Isabel Rowe reports.
After more than a decade of lobbying for change, sexual assault expert Karen Willis says clearer sexual consent laws in New South Wales are overdue.
We can't have accused who are just, I thought she was up for it. That's just not good enough.
Karen Willis is the Chief Executive of Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia. She represents one of several groups pushing for the introduction of affirmative consent into laws around assault and rape.
Which says that in the first instance, just the absence of words is not enough, that there actually must be a physical or a verbal, yes, you know, yahoo, yeah, honey, you're gorgeous, let's go, and nothing less, and that consent must be ongoing and can be withdrawn at any time.
The New South Wales government ordered an examination of the state's consent laws last year following the high-profile Luke Lazarus case. Mr. Lazarus was found not guilty of sexual assault in King's Cross in 2013, despite a jury and two judges finding that 18-year-old Jackson Mullins had not consented to sex with him. The jury found Mr. Lazarus believed the woman had consented. Karen Willis doesn't think that should be enough.
What we've actually recommended is that both parties need to agree through words and or actions that they are consenting to what's going on. That just the absence of no is not good enough.
I imagine, though, one of the biggest issues here is that no one usually is around to see what happens in these circumstances. And in court, it's a matter of he said, she said. So how does this help prove the issue in court?
Yeah. And look, that's always been one of the many problems with proving complaints of sexual assault. What these changes give is more information to judge and jury. So what did both parties say and what did they do?
Despite the recommendation of the Law Reform Commission and the majority of submitters, Australian Lawyers Alliance barrister Greg Barnes warns against the concept of affirmative consent.
The reality of a lot of sexual assault cases are that you do have, in some cases, people who have an honest but mistaken belief as to consent. And secondly, you have people who you might say are negligent about consent as opposed to people who deliberately assault a person. And the difficulty with the proposed change and the Tasmanian change is that it really equates all situations in the same way.
He believes young people, particularly those who combine sex with alcohol and drugs, can get it wrong.
It's in effect trying to simplify the law, but in fact will lead and can lead to injustice.
Karen Willis doesn't accept that.
We actually do quite a lot of training with young men around this, and what comes back clearly over and over again from them is that, oh, come on, really? People know when someone's consenting and when they're not.
New South Wales Attorney General Mark Speakman says he looks forward to reading the Law Reform Commission's draft recommendations. Those recommendations are open to more public submissions before the Commission makes its final report.
Isabel Rowe reporting. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hong Kong has once again erupted into violence, with tens of thousands of people taking part in illegal protests over the weekend. While police fired tear gas and water cannon into the crowds, some protesters threw petrol bombs and trashed businesses. It's a sign that this movement, which has now been going for nearly 5 months, isn't going away. Julia Holman reports.
It's been 2 weeks of relative calm in Hong Kong, but that all changed over the weekend. Tens of thousands took part in an anti-government rally that authorities forbid, and it quickly turned violent. Hardcore protesters vandalised Chinese-owned banks and companies that are seen as hostile to the movement, and they threw petrol bombs at police. In this video, police use water cannons to douse protesters in blue dye, used by authorities to identify demonstrators. Police also fired tear gas on the crowds. The protests in Hong Kong have been going on for nearly 5 months, and the weekend's events, which took place in a busy shopping district, weren't sanctioned by authorities. But that didn't deter tens of thousands of people from joining in. Many were wearing masks in defiance of a recent ban on face coverings at public gatherings. Claudia Mo is a pro-democracy legislator in Hong Kong and was at the protests on the weekend.
The police banned the rally, saying that, it's all due to public safety considerations and so on and so forth. And you can't help feeling that they're trying to incite this people against people fight. It's very Chinese Communist Party kind of tactic.
Claudia Mo, where do you see this protest movement going?
It's very difficult to see now. The government stands firm and the protesters also wouldn't budge. So we're at a deadlock. And right in the middle, there's just plenty of police brutality. Things are getting out of hand. Police aggressiveness is completely out of control.
Dr. Tim Summers is a senior consulting fellow on the Asia Pacific program at Chatham House and a lecturer at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He says the weekend's protests demonstrate growing anger against mainland China. China.
We did see a bit of further escalation in some of the attacks on banks, on MTR stations. There was a Xiaomi shop, a Chinese mobile phone company shop in Mong Kok, which was set ablaze. Those sort of tactics seem to be escalating if we compare where we are now with, say, a month ago in September. So I think meanwhile, we're going to see this ongoing contestation on the streets, mainly at the weekends, and with those targets perhaps continuing to expand even further from some of the radical protesters. I think this is going to go on for some time. Both sides seem dug in and neither seems prepared to make any fundamental compromises.
That's Dr. Tim Summers from the Chinese University of Hong Kong speaking there with our reporter Julia Holman. An alarming number of Australians are going hungry, lacking the necessary nutritious food to keep them healthy. Well, researchers at Monash University in Melbourne have found that's an increasingly common occurrence, with food insecurity now affecting 5 million Australians. They say the root cause is lack of income and are calling for a coordinated response to ensure nobody in Australia goes hungry. Oliver Gordon reports.
OK, everyone, pizza's ready!
It's afternoon tea time at the Gap Youth Centre in Alice Springs.
About the pizza at home baked, it's actually kind of a bit cheesy and stuff.
Young person Charolita has a slice and she's decided to give it a review.
Too many cheese and just too many tomato sauce and, yeah. But it kind of tastes really good and just, like 99% of it.
What's it like to come down to the Gap and have a slice of pizza?
Actually, the one thing about Gap is just how you get stuff health, like home-baked, healthy, kind of like breakfast and lunch and dinner. So it's easy and healthy for others to try get along with.
The Gap Youth Centre is funded to provide free meals to young people in Alice Springs 7 days a week. The centre's manager is Joseph Wiley.
How many people do you get coming down here to have a slice of pizza each night?
We're averaging about 60 people a night. We start off the day with fruits, from pears to apples to grapes, watermelons, kiwi fruits. Then we move into things like little pizzas for everyone, toasties. And then we're moving again into a full meal at the end of the night.
You're serving how many meals a year?
So it's 350 meals a week. I think that's turning into something like 18,000.
Not having enough to eat is a problem for an increasing number of Australians. New research by Monash University has found 5 million people are experiencing food insecurity, which is limited or uncertain access to sufficient nutritious food. Monash food and nutrition researcher Dr. Sue Cleave led the study.
If we look at over the population, about 4-5% of the population is experiencing food insecurity.
Dr. Cleave says too much of the response to food insecurity is going towards funding band-aid solutions, and more needs to be done to address the root causes of food insecurity.
Currently in Australia, our responses tend to be food-based responses, for example, in terms of providing food relief for people, which is an important kind of response. One of the key drivers or determinants of this issue is around adequate income. One of our major responses needs to be around outside of food provision and looking at big picture policies around things like adequate income for households.
Her new research examined all the available literature on food programs in Australia. It found that whilst many were doing important work, few had the time and resources available to tackle the major driver causing food insecurity, inadequate income. The researcher says in people's everyday lives, food budgets are often the first to be slashed when purse strings are being tightened.
The food budget is really what we call probably the elastic part of our people's budgets. It's got a little bit more room to move, like if people know that they've got an energy bill, they've got to pay rent or they've got a mortgage or those sorts of things, they're generally not that flexible. But a food budget, you can actually, if food is part of the budget that you can actually play around with a little bit.
Back at the Gap, Charolita is glad for the Gap's pizza and says it's better than what's on offer when the centre isn't open.
One thing, if you try the pizzas at Gap View Centre, it'll be much more better than the Domino's. And, yeah.
That's pizza lover Charolita at the Gap Youth Centre in Alice Springs, ending that report by Oliver Gordon. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. Linda Mottram and the PM crew will be along this evening. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the world. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Chris Dengate, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Australia's had troops in Afghanistan for 18 years now, and the official account of some of what's happened there is disputed. That includes the story behind a riot at an army base in 2010, sometimes called the Chora Rock Show.
Today's episode is all about what really happened that day. That's The Signal. You can find us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.